I've had many, many people say, I saw the fine print and I clicked the box, but I laughed because I thought that was just, that can never be me. Think about where you might turn if you get a surprise discovery.
Genetics isn't always black and white, and the emotions and decisions surrounding genetic testing can be even more complex. Welcome to Patient Stories with Gray Genetics. I'm Eleanor Griffith, a certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, a telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service. It seems like there are constantly headlines in the news about genetics, but few news stories focus on the patient experience. At Gray Genetics, we are collecting patient stories, your stories. Every other Tuesday, we share an interview with a patient or a genetic counselor.
I moved my support groups that were on Facebook, I moved them off of Facebook to a private site called Mighty Networks. You're paying for that privacy, essentially.
Brian Kirkpatrick is a licensed and certified genetic counselor and the founder of Watershed DNA. Brian is an author, blogger, speaker, and provides online group and individual support to those affected by unexpected DNA discoveries. Brian is a co-author of The DNA Guide for Adoptees and is currently working on her second book, one for individuals involved in surprise DNA family discoveries. Brian, so you were on the podcast 2 years ago. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again. Yeah, 2 years. It seems to have flown.
Yeah, exactly. In the past 2 years, what in direct-to-consumer testing has stayed the same and what has changed? Direct-to-consumer testing and ancestry testing.
Yeah, good question. So what has stayed the same? I would say the interest level on the aspect of consumers. If anything, I feel like the public is getting more comfortable with the idea of the DNA testing being something that you do in the comfort of your own home. So I feel like that aspect has stayed the same. And what has changed is that there are more resources available than the last time that we talked for people who make discoveries, surprise discoveries. And whether that's true, whether it's for a medical discovery that they've gotten from their at-home DNA test or a family discovery, which is what I specialize in now. There's just more resources, more genetic counselors are part of some of the companies that are providing the at-home tests. And outside of genetic counselors, there are more support organizations that have been founded really by people impacted by discoveries.
So those changes in terms of the number of resources to support people seems really positive. Do you see the overall direction having been positive in terms of what's going on with direct-to-consumer ancestry testing?
Yes, I do see it as positive in general, that there is a need for support and people who have realized that they have what is needed are stepping up and creating. You know, the Facebook groups have been around for a while, but now there's even groups off of Facebook. There are nonprofit organizations that have been founded. There was one founded back in 2017, which I think I talked about the last time, NPE Friends. And since then, another support organization, Right to Know, has formed. And there are more advocates on social media that are kind of pushing forward the idea of the importance of genetic identity, the rights of everybody to know who their genetic parents are and all of the benefits of that in terms of medical, our medical history is important, so we need to know parentage for that reason. In general, I would say the support has come from almost like grassroots movements and moving up from the bottom up. But I've also noticed some of the companies have started to take the advice that if they're going to be offering DNA tests, they also should be offering support and ways to get to support for people that discover unexpected findings. So both Ancestry and 23andMe have pages on their website to direct their testers who get a surprise to outside organizations for support.
Okay. And what about privacy issues? Any improvements in terms of privacy protections, or is that even feasible?
I do think that more people are aware that the consumer DNA testing can have more implications to their privacy, not only in the way that the databases are, like GenMatch, for example, are being used by law enforcement, but also, privacy in terms of a family secret being exposed. There have been more, media coverage of this particular topic and more discussions, although you could say I kind of have a biased, the people I'm interacting with are tend to be the people who have done a DNA test and then gotten the surprise afterward. So it's a little bit of a biased sample. But I do see more questions that, people I'm talking to just in everyday life, when they find out what I do, there is kind of more awareness that, privacy is a part of DNA testing and these consumer companies.
Has the work that you do changed?
It has. So I'm doing less of one-on-one client consultations at this point, where in the past I had people come to me and they would have a specific question in mind. For example, someone might come with their Prometheus report and want to talk about a particular finding that came up, or someone got a surprise finding, a surprise DNA match, and they wanted a second opinion. They wanted somebody to look through it. And I'm not doing as much of that work as I am helping connect people with support that exists. And one of those ways is I moved my support groups that were on Facebook. I moved them off of Facebook to a private site called Mighty Networks and created a support group and discussion forum on this separate site. And it's a membership. So some people have moved off of Facebook over to this site because there's a higher level of privacy, and some of the conversations, people feel more free to have conversations than they did before. So I'm spending more of my time, helping people as a group rather than one-on-one. And part of that too is we've branched out into weekly Zoom calls. So people who want to have face-to-face discussions over Zoom are part of our weekly Zoom calls. So my work has, the topic of my work has not changed, but the way that people are seeking out information and support has.
And Mighty Networks, do they also have advertisers, or do they not have advertisers? And is that part of why they have more privacy to offer people?
Yeah, that's why it's a paid site, because it's they don't have advertisements, and you're not linked to it's you sign up for a group specifically for that one group. You don't have all of your different Facebook groups popping up at once and having ads pop up. It's just a very different setup, but with the advantages of allowing for forum conversations, there are subgroups within the larger Watershed DNA Mighty Network. So I have a group for biological fathers that have been discovered from the DNA testing, and a group for spouses, and a group for adoptees, and a group for NPEs. So there's a lot more flexibility with it, and people have choice and control in a way that they didn't really have when we were having our groups on Facebook.
Do you find that people appreciate that and are willing to pay, or do you have people where you've just like lost from the support groups because there's just not a willingness to pay, when we're also used to having these services for quote unquote free, not really free, but without actually paying something that we can notice?
Yeah, there are some people who did not make the switch because there was a fee involved. And so I've tried to create content for everybody, no matter their level of ability to pay. So I still maintain the Watershed DNA blog on my watersheddna.com website, and that's all free content. And then at the Mighty Networks level, it's you're paying for that privacy, essentially. So people who either don't have an interest or don't have the means to have that will go to the Facebook groups instead. And because there are many of them that exist now on Facebook, I feel like there's a place they can go for support if they can't necessarily join the Mighty Network. But I've tried to make it available to as many people as possible.
Yeah. How much is it to be on the Mighty Networks?
It is, there's a monthly and an annual rate, and that right now it's about $20 a month at the monthly rate. And then the annual rate is a little bit less. It's like prorated, but less than you would if you were paying the monthly rate.
I guess that's more than I would have thought, but also makes me think that if you have people in those support groups, those are people who are really committed to being in those support groups. I've joined Facebook groups kind of on a whim and then never checked them.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of accountability for people that are involved, but most of the people who join are already working with counselors, like working with a therapist or a couples counselor. And so if you compare the copay or what you might pay out of pocket for working with a counselor or a therapist, it's, some people see the value in getting, I guess you would call it like content that's already been curated. So I post articles, I post other resources, I post a weekly writing prompt. So they're getting a lot of content for the price, but not everybody has the same value or really knows what to expect when they join. So that's kind of one of those ongoing, I'm always trying to figure out what do people need and how can I help them? How can I help meet that need? And if I can't, how can I help them connect with someone else who can?
I'm curious if you've seen the pandemic change anything for people or bring up different issues just because of the peculiar stresses that people are under now?
Yeah. So at the beginning of the pandemic, it was very, very quiet in the Mighty Networks group because everyone was just so wrapped up in adjusting to the new world that we were living in. But after a couple of months, people came back, conversations renewed. And since then, there have actually been a lot of pandemic surprises where people were home, and so they decided to get into genealogy a little bit, decided to do a DNA test, and lo and behold, they found out something they were not expecting to find out, and so now they're looking for support. You know, I think people were Googling and searching the internet for support before the pandemic, and they're just still continuing to do the same thing. And because it's hard for people to discuss these discoveries with family and friends that don't really understand what that discovery is like. Mm-hmm. It's the internet where people turn because that's where other people who've been through a similar experience are.
Right. And you're actually starting your own podcast in January. Is that right?
I am. I'm working on first episode, hoping that it will be ready in January, but if not, then early part of 2021. And that this has been something that I've wanted to do for a while, but it's just one of those things that you have to prioritize what project you're working on next. And had someone offer to help me get it all set up and get going because they really wanted me to start a podcast to talk about some of the issues that are not necessarily being discussed elsewhere. So it's going to be called DNA Clarity and Support with Brian. I'm hoping to interview authors of books that have written for the audience of DNA testers, whether that's for medical testing or family DNA surprise testing. Hoping to interview people who have created resources and just help listeners understand that the experiences that they're going through or have gone through are not isolated to them. So just be a source of validation for these experiences and help people connect with the resources that would help them.
Yeah. And do you know, is it going to be weekly or monthly, or is that decided yet?
Undecided, probably monthly at first. And if there is demand, I will keep going for sure. So I have different ideas for episodes that I think would help the audience. But, you know, I think sometimes you just wait and see what people are asking for, because you might have one idea and, you know, other people say, well, that's not what we need. What we need is this. So I try to be flexible and open and listen and then respond to those needs.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, whenever you have that all set up, we will also add that to the show notes for this episode too.
We'll be back with patient stories in just a minute.
Have you ever wondered how your own family medical history might impact your personal health risks? Or maybe you're wondering if you'd be a good candidate for genetic testing, but you aren't quite ready to commit to a full genetic counseling session. Our Family History Review is perfect for those seeking more information and guidance before making an appointment with a genetic counselor. Simply answer a few questions about your personal and family medical history, and a certified genetic counselor will review it and return a written evaluation right to your email inbox in 3 to 5 business days. They will also provide you with a personalized risk assessment and even recommend to you what your next steps could be. Check out this service and more on greygenetics.com. That's G-R-E-Y genetics.com.
I believe when you came on the podcast last time, you just published a book, co-authored the book DNA Guide for Adoptees, and I believe you're working on a new book now.
I am, and it's taking a while because how I envisioned the book at first is turning out to be different. I think that happens a lot when you get started on a project. So originally, it was going to be the DNA Guide for NPEs. NPEs are people who discover that their father, typically it's who their father, the father that raised them, is not their biological father. And it was going to be similar to the DNA Guide for Adoptees, but for that audience. And over the past couple of years, it's become really clear to me that it's not just the people who make the discovery about their own parentage that are looking for support and guidance. It's everybody involved in these family discoveries, including the new biological family that they are being matched to or discovering that they have. So I'm taking a step back and trying to create a book that's going to help everybody understand all of the different experiences, because communication and boundary setting is really difficult in these new family discoveries, because it's essentially strangers that have found one another because of DNA testing, and they've got to figure out a way forward, and whether that, you know, includes a long-term relationship and, you know, what that looks like for the families is really complex. So I'm hoping to create something that's a little bit more wide-reaching, and just based on everything that I've learned and people and families that I've worked with, that's just a resource that will be available to more.
I'm sure I asked you this 2 years ago. I don't know if the answer is the same or has changed, but about how common is it that someone does DNA testing, like ancestry testing, and then finds out that, you know, their father is not who they expected, or another category of surprise that you see come up?
Yeah, it's a big question, and answering it's really hard, because how it depends on how you define, you know, a surprise family discovery. Because if you discover a half sibling that your father is that person's father too, you're not involved in that discovery, but it still turns your life upside down and affects you as well. So there's not really anyone who's gathering the data. The companies don't really even know every situation of their test leading to a surprise discovery for a family. So it's really hard to put a number on it. In the past, I've always said it's probably about 5 to 10% of testers. And that's based on discussions I've had with genealogists that are doing tests for multiple people in their family, and from people who run DNA family projects where they're tracking the Y DNA along with the surname. And about 1 in 10 of the times that someone wants to, you know, participate in one of these projects, the Y chromosome doesn't end up matching the surname. So there are a couple of ways we can try to guess what the number probably is. And Libby Copeland, who's the author of the book, The Lost Family, has explored and tried to answer that question as well. And she's estimated maybe about 3% of the consumer DNA testers have gotten some type of really close, unexpected discovery. But I don't know, it's so hard to put a number on that because it's like a moving target, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You try to define it, and then you have to consider all of these other situations and consider whether to include those as well.
With the different support resources that are out there and just so many people doing testing, are you finding, are people less surprised than they used to be? Or is this one of those things where everyone, even if you're aware, you think, yes, yes, but that won't happen to me?
Yes, everyone's still surprised. And it's very common that they go through like a shock and a grief process. And it's not something that you can skip over just because you knew that it was a possibility that it could happen. And I've had many, many people say, I saw the fine print and I clicked the box, but I laughed because I thought that was just, that can never be me. I think that is still happening.
What's the process for people to come to terms with that, or how long does that usually take, or is that too hard to say because it really depends on the individual and all the individual circumstances?
Yeah, how long it takes for people to adjust to that shock depends on a lot of factors, like if they kind of suspected that they may not have the same father as their half-siblings. Maybe it's confirming what they always suspected all along. So that's going to be a different type of adjustment than somebody who really had no inkling and no clue, and it just came out completely out of left field for them. So it's really individual based on all of the different factors involved in their discovery. Yeah, I guess their preparation ahead of time. And I don't know if there's any way around that, really, or if we're just at the point that we need to be ready whenever somebody makes the discovery and kind of intercept them early on and help them get connected with the support at that point.
Is it still common for people to give ancestry testing as gifts, or is that something where either the perception has shifted to think that it's more something you decide to buy for yourself or not? Or is it that everyone, are they gifted out? The people who would have bought them as gifts have done that.
I don't have an answer to that question. It's a really okay. good one.
I know it's moved off of my like mind, but I don't know if that's just because I got used to the idea and stopped focusing on it. Maybe I'm not on Facebook or I'm not on the right parts of Google to be seeing those ads for gift giving.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if after the holidays, if the companies come out and talk about how many kits they sold, because I know they've done that in past years. Like they'll say, you know, Black Friday was our biggest sale, biggest day ever of selling our tests. So I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question. I would like to think that people are listening and thinking ahead of time a little bit and maybe reconsidering DNA may not be the best gift to give somebody for a birthday or a holiday or, you know, Mother's or Father's Day. But it's hard. I don't know. I don't know how rates of testing have changed, I guess you could say.
And over the past 2 years, are there any specific patient stories, patients' experiences with DNA testing and DNA surprises that have really stuck with you?
Yeah. And when I think of patients, I think of like medical genetics backgrounds. And there have been a couple of members of the Watershed DNA support group that have found their way to the group because in uncovering their medical finding, it also uncovered a surprise connection to family that they didn't know about. So I'm thinking of this one member in particular, and she had done 23andMe just out of interest and had not only learned that she was an NPE, but also learned that she was a carrier of a BRCA variant, and I can't remember now if it was BRCA1 or 2, but she was positive for BRCA variant. And it ended up coming from the line of her family that was from her biological father. So she had no, she didn't have family medical, accurate family medical history. And so she was kind of dealing with two things at once, the discovery that her father who raised her was not biologically her father. And she also had this unknown genetic risk factor that she had just found out about. So that was an interesting kind of connection between the medical side of genetics and the family side of genetics, that we genetic counselors know that there's that connection there and how important it is to have accurate medical family history. But her story really hit home that point.
Yeah, and I guess that's a patient who wouldn't have been referred to genetic counseling based on her family history, right? Because she had wrong paternal family history information.
Right. Right. So she ended up meeting with a genetic counselor to have it confirmed, which it was, it confirmed positively that she was a carrier. And that genetic counselor had told her about watershed DNA being a resource for the NPE aspect. So it was a situation of, you know, genetic counselors helped her on various aspects, but if she had not been the one to take that consumer test, it all would have remained a mystery to her.
Yeah, and 23andMe is still just testing for the three common variants in BRCA mutations that are common to people of Ashkenazi ancestry. Is that right?
Correct.
Did she happen to have Ashkenazi ancestry on her father's side at least?
She did, and well, that was another discovery of the testing as well, because she was not raised Jewish and did not know that she had Ashkenazi Jewish ethnic background. So for her, she wouldn't have been able to report that to her doctor.
Yeah, are you finding many people who really are interested in the family medical history aspect of this? Is that a norm for people to be very interested in gathering that information and seeing if it changes medical recommendations? Or is that just something I think about as a genetic counselor?
It does come up in discussion, actually. And so in the group, there are often discussions between the bio dads, the children that didn't know they had a different father, and then the wives of the bio dads. And one of the things that I hear come up often is that they all agree that family medical history is almost a given. Like if the biological child shows up, we definitely will provide the medical family history. But beyond that, you know, is there going to be a relationship or not? That's up in the air and just depends on a lot of factors. But there's a lot of agreement and consensus amongst everybody involved that the medical aspect of it is important and should be shared.
Any advice that you would give to people who either they still haven't taken an ancestry test, but they've been one of those people just thinking about it for a really long time, or someone who has taken a test and has a surprise in the results that they haven't dealt with yet?
So for a person who has not taken a test yet, but is considering it, think about where you might turn if you get a surprise discovery. And do you know where you would turn in your family for support? Do you know where you would turn on the internet or to your medical, the medical professionals in your life? Like, are you ready to kind of take the next step if you get a surprise? And just think about that, I guess, is my advice, because I see advantages and disadvantages of it, and you never know until you test which group you're going to fall into. So that's my advice for people who haven't tested yet but have an interest. And for people that have made a discovery, my first piece of advice is to make sure that you aren't misinterpreting the results, because the cases are rare, but there are cases of misinterpreting the family relationships based on what the company has told you. So at 23andMe, for example, they will report somebody as a half-sibling or as a first cousin, but those relationship assignments can be wrong. It can falsely tell you that a first cousin's a half-sibling and vice versa. So first of all, don't jump to conclusions until you've ruled out all the other possibilities for why your result might be looking unexpected and not matching to who you're expecting to match to. And then after that, my advice is to look for support where you can find it, but not expect the people in your life to really understand what you're going through unless they've been through it themselves. So there are many, many people that you can connect with online that have been through that experience and understand it as a shock and a trauma, and they know what that experience is like, and trying to get that support from your own family and friends, it's possible, but it doesn't happen easily for everybody.
Yeah. And can we include links to your Mighty Network support groups in the show notes, or how does that work? Since are they private groups? And I know it's a paid site, so I'm not sure how the direct links work.
Yes. So I have a direct link. I have two links. I have one link that goes to my website to describe the group, and a second link that goes to Mighty Networks for the sign up.
Okay, great. So we can include both of those. And even though you're seeing you have more limited availability to work with patients one-on-one, you are still available for that. Is that right? Even though there might be a little bit of a wait?
Yes. Yeah, I still do take one-on-one clients on a limited basis. And if someone can be a little bit patient and also explain ahead of time what they're hoping to achieve, that can help me schedule somebody or connect them with a different therapist or counselor or somebody else who might be a better fit. But yes, I do still see one-on-one clients on a more limited basis.
Okay. And the best way to schedule that is still just go to watersheddna.com/schedule.
Yes.
And looking at your site for scheduling an appointment, it looks like someone can choose different areas of focus depending on what kind of support they're looking for. So someone could make an appointment because they want to know which DNA test to do, or an ethics consultation, or navigating life after a DNA surprise, or a package of sessions for someone who's looking to share information with family members and wanting support.
I've tried to make it clear what someone should schedule with me in terms of how much time it will take depending on their issue. So someone who is trying to adjust to a DNA surprise that's affected them, whether it's they're the person affected or they're in the life of someone who is affected, those require a little bit more time, like closer to an hour, to really have a helpful discussion and to figure out what someone needs, kind of guide them to the next steps after that. But if someone has a really focused question, like they're dealing with an ethics question, a concern about ethics in a particular situation they're involved in, or they're just trying to decide between a couple of different DNA tests, those are a much shorter conversation. So I've tried to create a couple of different options so that people can find their way to the one that's going to fit them the best.
Yeah, I think those options are really clear. So looking ahead to 2020 ending, which has been a really weird year, and looking forward to 2021 and hopefully, you know, 2022, maybe without a global pandemic, what changes do you kind of foresee happening in the future?
That's a good question, because I feel like 2020 really moved the bar in terms of what we, how we handle things that are unexpected and out of our control. So a silver lining to come from it, from my perspective, is that so many more people are comfortable with technology, like using Zoom or using a telegenetics platform, that maybe they would never have considered that in the past. And now, because they've been forced into a situation where they had to use that to connect with other people, it's normal now. And maybe that will be a hurdle that so many more people can overcome now, if that was keeping them from meeting with a genetic counselor or being part of an online support group or something like that. So to me, that's a silver lining. We have to look for them where we can find them, right?
Right, definitely. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me again.
thank you for having me. It's been a great conversation as usual, and I appreciate it.
And yeah, whenever you get that first podcast out, we'll definitely update the show notes. Excited to hear it.
Thank you.
Patient Stories is an ad-free podcast and is unaffiliated with any commercial genetic testing laboratories. We would like to keep it that way. You can now donate to Patient Stories online by going to graygenetics.com/podcast/donate. If you don't want to make a monetary donation but still want to support the show in another way, leaving a review on iTunes or sharing our episodes through social media also makes a big difference.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.